You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 3rd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, nation writer, host of Politics and Reality Radio, Joshua Holland. If progressives, it's time for progressives to start sweating healthcare details. Also on the program today, White House goes full white supremacy amid plummeting polls. McMaster axes Flynn loyalists. And Kelly tells Sessions, I got your racist back. Meanwhile, somebody leaked Donald Trump's phone calls to the Mexican and Australian president / prime minister. DHS agents, apparently, during the Muslim ban, told to blow off congressmen.
That was General Kelly, incidentally.
And across our government, more officials rebuke Trump. Meanwhile, the House Intel wants to see Junior's phone records and the Senate to see at least one bill, a bipartisan bill, protecting Mueller. Georgia disenfranchises 500,000 voters, while Kris Kobach must tell all of his voter suppression talks with Donald Trump. And scientists have edited a mutation from an embryonic gene. Genetic engineering, folks.
What?
Not just for soybeans anymore. And lastly, Trump wants all of Afghan minerals, and he's mad at his generals.
Minerals good. Generals thought were good, but now bad. Also unfair. We were talking about adoption.
I don't know if you've ever been to this 21 Club, but there's a lot to learn from what they were doing. We'll talk more about that later.
Maybe all this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen.
Maybe I should fly to Afghanistan and tell some village kids about a boat orgy I was at in the 80s and how there was another real estate developer who came in, but he didn't have any money anymore, so he wasn't invited to the orgy anymore, and it was sad. It might inspire them.
It is. We are so knee-deep in white supremacy today. It's pretty sad. I'm just looking down at the sound list, and it's pretty impressive what's going on right now. I mean, broadly, I'm going to give you a broad overview of what took place yesterday. It's one of those sort of overwhelming days where there was so much news, and it was hard to sort of get a sense of what was most important. But, and so I'm just going to try and lay it out for you. And I should say we're going to be talking to Josh Holland. And yesterday, for some reason, it just so happened, there were two big pieces on healthcare that I was interested in. One was by John Walker, who was a former Fire Dog Lake news guy, followed up David Dan, and good writer, very smart guy. And he wrote a proposal up that was sort of based, loosely based on AmeriCare, which was a Congressman Pete Stark proposal. And Josh Holland wrote this piece in The Nation, which basically argue that Medicare for all is not necessarily the answer, we got to start looking at the details for this. And my thinking on this is that now really is the time. I mean, I don't know if the Republican repeal and replace is dead, but now is the time to really start to understand what could work better. And not just as a political, not just from a rhetorical standpoint, but one that actually a mechanism that actually would work once it was in place. Because you don't want to have this argument, this debate, this discussion when it comes time to really push it politically, it seems to me. Because then you start to undercut the political message. So we're going to talk to Josh Allen about that. But here's some of the bigger stories. McMaster basically got rid of the guy who was giving Nunes, who gave Nunes that information back in the day, and a former Flynn loyalist on the National Security Council. This is a bit of a rebuke, I guess, to Bannon. Simultaneously, Kelly says to Sessions, I got your back. There's two ways to read that. One is he wants to make sure that Mueller can go ahead with his investigation. But I think there's other ways for Donald Trump to get rid of Mueller if he wants. It's another way of maybe Kelly signaling like, hey, for whatever reason, people seem to think I'm not some huge white supremacist myself. I want to make it absolutely clear. Simultaneously, yesterday, there was a Freedom of Information Act which revealed emails between Department of Homeland Security officials basically saying, hey, if congressmen, congresspeople or lawyers get wind of it, just ignore them. Which, you know, congresspeople find inappropriate. And remember, this is over the Muslim ban. That was a DHS, obviously, under Kelly's auspices. In addition, yesterday, they trotted out guy most likely to be written about by the next Hannah Arendt. what is it? Miller? What? I don't know his
Stephen
first name.
Miller.
Stephen Miller. They trotted out Stephen Miller to announce the president's support for a bill that already got introduced in April by Tom Cotton and some other white supremacist to shrink the number of legal immigrants allowed into this country and, perhaps even more importantly, create qualifications and require a qualifications matrix, if you will, that would separate families and keep families separate and also really is designed to make sure that you have immigrants who come from primarily white countries, basically white immigrants.
What now, a shocking thing to say.
And it's a shocking thing to say. But I would also say that this is they know this bill has no chance of getting 60 votes any in the Senate. And they still came out and promoted it, which suggests to me, and perhaps they were doing it because there were huge poll numbers that came out that showed that even with their you know, more racist base, they're losing support. The president is losing support. Some people have suggested this is a way of saying, like, hey, we don't need Sessions to be a white supremacy administration. We can do this without him. That's why we brought out young Miller.
I always knew I couldn't trust the young Jew.
Exactly.
I used his Jew IQ to advance the agenda, but now as in line with the devilish snake-like money-lending nature, he is knifing me in the back. at least Scaramucci, that Italian, did it from the front.
That's right. But, you know, Kelly did say to Sessions, don't worry, you're still our number one white supremacist. So it's unclear. I mean, I think there's two ways to look at this. One, they need to shore up their poll numbers. Two, maybe they need to shore up their poll numbers because maybe they are going to get rid of Sessions. Maybe the reason why we know that Kelly told Sessions is because there's talk about getting rid of Sessions. And Kelly basically said, this is how I go about this. I'm going to put it out there. And now you're going to put me in a corner. I mean, that's basically the way you get leverage to those things.
I was at a human cranium conference in Russia while you were getting peed on. So you fire me at your own risk, sir.
Now, on top of that, somebody leaked the transcripts from conversations that Donald Trump had with President Enrique Nieto. Pinieto. And they are, you could not find transcripts that make Donald Trump look weaker and more pathetic and sad to his wall-loving racist base than these transcripts.
He makes us look weak. Which, by the way, we no longer are, believe me.
So that was the past 24 hours, ladies and gentlemen. We will see. And did I mention yesterday that the Mueller hired another lawyer, DOJ yes. lawyer? Okay.
Yeah, focused on foreign bribery, I believe.
Yes.
He's like staffed up. Like, all right, we've got money
this guy
laundering.
Took out the Bonanno family. What? Apparently.
The what? They kept the best books.
I'm hoping
things are getting really bad now.
I'm hoping the Trump admin lasts long enough for there to be like a fantasy sports style, like make your own investigation team.
Rotisserie. Oh, God. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to have this less tied to the news of the day conversation with Josh Holland. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. It is your support that makes this show possible every day. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you some extra content at the end of the free program. All right, quick break. We'll be right back with Josh Holland. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Joshua Holland. He is a contributor to The Nation magazine, a fellow at The Nation Institute, and also the host of Politics and Reality Radio, available on all of your podcast platforms on demand, not unlike this program. Joshua, welcome to the program.
Sam, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start in with your piece. I mean, it was there was a couple of pieces that came out yesterday or in the past couple of days, and presumably it's because we've got I don't know if the last nail has been put into the coffin, but there's probably still half a dozen nails to put into the coffin of the Republican repeal and replace. But we're getting to the point where people are starting to look past this, and where progressives should put their energy next. And so give me a sense of why you set out to write this piece.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think that within the broad left, you know, the Democratic slash progressive coalition, the discussion about health care is clearly shifting towards the left. I think that we should acknowledge the good that the Affordable Care Act did, but at the same time, I don't think there's a lot of appetite to stick with that kind of model, you know, or tinker around the edges, given that we have seen that it has left about 10% of the population uninsured. And so, you know, we've seen some mainstream Democrats, Kristen Gillibrand, she said that she is advocating Medicare for all. Chuck Schumer said that it is now on the table. Single payer is on the table. So I think that the debate is heading that way. And one of my concerns is that it appears that on the left, and within the activist community, which is where all the energy is right now, we've made a litmus test out of a specific policy approach rather than kind of starting at the broad principle that healthcare should be a human right and it should be, and I'm not talking about, you know, access to healthcare in an emergency room like the conservatives talk about. I mean, comprehensive healthcare, preventive services, et cetera, should be a human right guaranteed by the government. And if we started that position, then we should be able to have an open debate about the best way to get there. And the current proposals for Medicare for All, I think, are flawed. I don't think they're the best way to go. And that's not a reflection of my ideological centrism, because I'm not a centrist, nor am I captured by the establishment or anything like that. So I wanted to come out.
We'll decide that.
And show that, yeah, you know, I mean, if you look at my Twitter TL, you may see some differing opinions on that. But the bottom line is I wanted to come out and say, look, this stuff is complicated. Healthcare isn't easy. And we really need to grapple with the complexities. And we haven't so far. I don't think that the left has done a good job of really grappling with how hard it is to transition a system that represents 18% of the economy into this single payer model. And I point out that, you know, I hear a lot, well, every other country has, it's not true that every other country has single payer, but every other country has a universal healthcare scheme, which is true, but no country has ever set up a national universal health care scheme when they're spending more than 5% of their GDP on health care. So what we're talking about doing is making that transition at 18%, which means that, yes, other countries have set up these systems, but what we're talking about is unprecedented. We have to figure out how to deal with it. The financing isn't simple. It's dishonest to say that we can't afford it because we're already spending a ton on health care, but that doesn't mean that the actual way that you finance it is going to be obvious or simple. We need to really grapple with this stuff.
And all right, so the concern is that we're, I mean, because I don't know. I mean, I would suspect that you could take 10 people who support Medicare for All, and they really wouldn't know the intricacies, and a sizable percentage of those people wouldn't know the intricacies of Medicare. I mean, I don't even feel like I, and I'm very supportive of the program and talk about it often, but I think I might be in one of those, you know, those who don't really understand the intricacies of the program. But is the concern that if just the words Medicare for All, like those words are adopted from a political standpoint, we are somehow boxed in to a specific, you know, actual pen to paper policy, or is it? I mean, so in other words, like it, to me, okay, Medicare for All.
Let me try to address that. So it doesn't need to be. I love the politics of Medicare for All, and I believe that we should I believe we should keep the label, to tell you the truth. I am worried that we are being boxed into a specific policy under the rubric of Medicare for All by the John Conyers policy, because there are specific proposals out there. John Conyers' plan in the House has 115 Democratic co-sponsors. Bernie Williams is coming out with one. We don't yet know the details, but we can look at his 2013
Bernie
Senate
Sanders.
Bill.
Bernie Sanders,
yeah.
Former Yankee fan. He said Bernie Williams.
We can... Did I say Bernie Williams?
Yes.
I was just reading this Yankee thing. Okay, I'm sorry about that. Bernie Sanders, we know that his 2013 plan was it's the for all thing. What do you mean by for all?
Right.
This is the crucial thing. There are two ways to address. There are two progressive ways to. I mean, there's probably more than two. The basic approaches to the problems that we have is that we still have 10% of the population uninsured. We can create a new public health care program or get them into an existing public health care program to make sure that nobody is uninsured while leaving people who are happy with their coverage that they get through their employer or through a union or through the Veterans Administration with their coverage. Or we can take everybody, regardless of whether they're happy or not with their insurance, and stick them into a Medicare-like program. These are the two, like, kind of broad brush approaches. And my fear with the putting everybody into one program, as opposed to making sure that everybody is covered with good insurance, is that it's a loser. And the reason that I think this, one of the big reasons that I think this, is I'm just looking at the lessons that we've learned from the last few years. It's about loss aversion. People are freaked out by the idea of losing the coverage that they have. And even if you say, look, this thing that you're going to get is better, that doesn't matter in terms of the psychology of it. So when the Affordable Care Act came out, right, Obama, and he shouldn't have done this, he said, go ahead.
Well, I want to back up just a little bit here, because there's a couple of things that I think there are terms that get thrown around that I think that make me suspicious, and that I think
people... Am I wonking out?
No. That's not a problem at all. We want to do that. But I want to just back up, because as you refer to the problem that we have with insurance, you keep referring to universality. And one of the things...
Yeah.
And it seems to me the problem with the Affordable Care Act was that it was sold as being universal, and B, it was sold as being affordable. Now, I happen to think that the biggest problem that with the politics of it was that the ACA part was emphasized, the Affordable Care Act part, as opposed to the Patient Protection Act part of it, which fully delivered. In other words, we got much better product. You know, that's why you had 25% less bankruptcies across the board, 50% less medical bankruptcies, because the actual insurance, although it was more expensive, I think, for a lot of people, and it didn't address the cost for, I don't know, 80% of the people, 90% of the people who actually have health insurance, before it was instituted, because everybody thought, like, oh, this is going to lower our rates of insurance. Well, no, actually, the only thing that most people got was an actual product that they thought they were buying all this time. And that's why you saw the bankruptcies drop so dramatically, because insurance actually functioned the way that people presumed it should. So when I hear someone talk about universality, I'm not talking about you, but when I hear a politician say universal, as opposed to a single payer, I get a little suspicious, because I start thinking, like, oh, wait a second. You know, the ACA, it didn't fully get to universality, but the real dilemma with ACA, you know, and we're putting aside the expansion of Medicaid here for a moment, from the perspective of most Americans, the ACA did not deliver what we came to call it, which was the Affordable Care Act. It didn't make insurance more affordable. And universality, okay, that is one component of it, but it also should not be such a huge source of anxiety for you that you're going to lose your job and you're going to lose your health insurance, or that it's expensive, or that next year it's going to cost me 20% than it cost this year. I mean, and it's the fact that you need like a, you know, some type of accounting degree to really sort of manage, you know, and the paperwork and all of it, it's just a nightmare. And so there, I mean, and we should say that single payer, and then the irony of this is that single payer does not, I mean, it's going to reduce the cost of insurance a little bit, but it's not going to reduce really the main driver. It's not really going to address the main driver of costs, except for as a bank shot, which is the cost of medicine, period. And the idea of a single payer is just going to be that you have one bargainer, essentially, one buyer, and it's going to make it a little bit cheaper because they're going to be able to negotiate better. But largely speaking, we have a medical cost problem in this country, not as much as an insurance cost problem. Does that make sense?
I mean, that is 100% correct. We spend far more for goods and services than anybody else does. Already about half of our health care is covered by public, is financed by through the public sector. So, you know, then within the private sector, lots of companies self-insure. They're not paying insurers' profits. Insurers' profits and those administrative fees are certainly something that we would save if we went to single payer, but it would not be some sort of magic bullet that would bring our healthcare spending in line with those other countries. And one of the points that I made in the piece is that all of those other countries, they set up their single payer systems when they were spending 2 or 3% of their GDP on healthcare, and then they aggressively kept costs in check through various cost controls. So we are going to have to separate these things out to some degree, in that, you know, we need to figure out the structure of how to get to universality, and not BS universality like the Affordable Care Act. And let's also acknowledge that it would have been closer to the promise if not for the Supreme Court striking down the Medicaid expansion, right? I mean, it would have been a lot closer to that promise of universality. We did insure 14 million people through the Medicaid expansion, and then that was in about 30 states, right? But the point, these are separate issues, and they are going to be dogged, and they're going to be complex, and there's a whole other discussion about how we need to keep costs in check. That it's like it's a completely different topic, and it has to do with changing the way that we pay for healthcare services. At some point, we have to start challenging these industries directly, which is a separate fight that you need to have. Like, the idea that the government can't negotiate with pharmaceutical companies is crazy, right? That's insane. And whether we go to single payer or some hybrid system or stay with the status quo, that's a separate fight that we need to have. It's not inherent in the structure. It's a different fight.
Is it? But here's my one. Let me just make one point about that, and then I'll let you do the only reason I would say that it's not a distinct fight is that if I agree with you that you know, and I look at Medicare for All as really more a euphemism in many respects. In the same way that we hear people say I'm for universal care, and that can mean a lot of different things. In practice. But the idea of Medicare for All, the idea of single payer, it seems to me, also creates a certain sense of solidarity, so that it not only and in the sense that, like, you know, single payer, it can impact costs because you have a single negotiator, right? And who's buying in volume, and they're the buyer, and so there's a certain monopoly power that they have. I guess a monopsony. I'm not sure if it's actually fair to use that word in that context, but that they have that power. And there's also a psychological impact there, it seems to me, too, that if we're all in the same boat, if it's actually all of our healthcare system, the ability to say to doctors or the ability to say to massive hospitals, hey, look, you know, when you're gouging all of us, not just some of it, you're gouging all of us. That seems to be somewhat relevant for that fight. Now, maybe I'm getting a little bit too precious with that, but I mean, what's your take on that? Because, you know, we keep sort of...
I mean, I've been advocating for single payer for many years, and I think that it is an ideal system. I think it's better than Medicare for most, right, which is the alternative. I want to just step back to this point that I think is really important about risk aversion, loss aversion, being the, like, driving force in the politics of healthcare. The ACA, Obama promised you could keep your policy if you like your policy, right? About 1.5 million people lost the policies that they had, and those were mostly substandard, like, MIC policies, right? They didn't really cover you if you got sick. Obamacare extended decent coverage to 15 times as many people. And yet, those 1.5, 1.6 million people created an absolute firestorm. So if you were to move everybody into Medicare, if you were to achieve single payer by making it truly Medicare for all, not as a euphemism, but Medicare for all, you would be asking 70% of the adult population to lose the coverage that they have now, and you'd be promising that they would have something better. In many cases, though, you wouldn't be able to fulfill that promise, because millions and millions of people have very, very good health care, like Cadillac insurance. And all of those people would, in actual fact, lose out if we went to a Medicare system, Medicare for all system. And I'm not talking about a few rich people. I'm talking like union members who have negotiated these excellent health care plans for their members, right? A lot of people would lose out. So the two approaches are to universal health care that will be on the table, because there's a plan being developed right now that would create a Medicare Part E, call it Part E, a big new public health care program that would cover with heavily subsidized Medicare program that would cover everybody who's uninsured and would give everybody the opportunity to buy in. That is, companies could buy in and insure their people. People like me, I don't know if you're on an individual in the individual market, but I am, and it sucks. Mm. We could buy into that new Medicare Part E, and it would create a very, very large pool.
Could you buy in?
And it would
Could you buy in if you were working for an employer who had the option of buying in? Could you do that individually if the employer said no?
Well, this is a proposal, and they're developing right now, and that's a level of detail that I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
I honestly don't know. It may be that your employer will have to okay it. It may not be. But your employer will have to either give you insurance that is just as good or put you in that thing.
Okay.
Right? So every employee is covered. And then we need to figure out a way to get people who are unattached to the workforce into this program. And there's a number of different mechanisms that could come out in the mix. The mechanism of Obamacare with a modest mandate is obviously insufficient, right? So we need to do better. But the bottom line is, you know, do you want to tell 70% of the population that they're going to lose their coverage for something else, or do you want to say we're going to fill in all the gaps here?
All right.
And one of the points that I make in the piece, and this is this is, it got, you know, it's like, my editor was like, why are you saying this? And I was like, look, people need to understand that when they think of these pristine single-payer systems in these other countries, they're getting a false picture, because all of these countries have complicated mishmashes of public health care, some private insurance, mandatory insurance, and there is no, like, clean, you know, simple, oh, we all pay taxes and then the government just pays all the medical bills. That doesn't exist. So, I mean, we definitely shouldn't promise more than other countries have. If you look at the John Conyers bill, just for example, it covers everything, almost everything, not plastic surgery, but everything other than like plastic surgery it covers. And then it says, oh, you won't have any copays. No deductibles, nothing out of pocket. Nobody does this, right? I mean, you look at Canada, they don't cover prescriptions. They don't cover eye care. They don't cover dental. So 2/3 of Canadians have a private supplemental insurance plan. They do it to pick up the co-payments and to cover those things that Medicare, which is a great program, the Canadian Medicare program, doesn't cover. And that's true in all of these countries.
So here's where I'm confused, because on one level I totally agree, and you know, one of the things that we've talked about on this program for a while is just sort of there's an opaqueness between, you know, the policy proposal from a political standpoint and then just actually what the policy is and what it's going to mean for people on the ground.
Right.
But it seems to me that on some way the arguments you're making also could be made in favor of just saying we should just call it Medicare for All as a policy proposal on a political level. And I'll tell you why. Because
I'm with you. I say let's just call it Medicare for All.
Oh, all right. Well,
I love the rhetoric of Medicare for All. And I think that when you look at something like a lot of these polls that say people love the idea of Medicare for All, the way they're phrased, it's not clear that people who have insurance understand that they would go into the program as well.
Well, yeah.
So
yes.
Let's call it Medicare for All and let's fill in the gaps.
Well,
let's,
I think, like, Medicare for
Medicare
All,
Medicare to cover everybody who isn't covered.
And Medicare for All could also just mean that it's available for all. I mean, here's the thing is that I think that it's The irony about the exchanges, just broadly speaking, is that we were still always talking about a very small percentage of the American public who were actually implicated in the exchanges. And,
oh, absolutely.
And yet it was the primary factor. And that was, I think, I'm just convinced, the politics of the way that the Affordable Care Act was sold. It just was misnamed. It really should have been
the
Patient
right.
Protection,
I mean,
Universal
absolutely right.
Care Act. And then it would have delivered on everything that it promised. And the idea that the right could make such a big deal about the Obama's promise is indicative of how there is a disconnect between the actual facts on the ground, not just the policy, but actually as they hit the ground, and the politics of it.
Well, that's also indicative of the challenge of actually doing Medicare for everybody. So I love the politics. I love Medicare for All. As a way of framing what we should do. I mean, it's perfect because Medicare is familiar. It's popular. It's not scary. It's not foreign. People understand it, you know, as opposed to saying, oh, single payer, or, you know, what is this other thing, this weird thing that lefties are talking about? It's Medicare. You know it. Your mother is on it, your grandmother, whatever. I am worried that we are making a litmus test out of a specific set of policy goals and calling that Medicare for All. I say let's make sure that we start with a principle. Let's cover everybody, and then let's have an open dialogue about how best to get there without assuming that, you know, if you think that people who have decent coverage should keep that coverage, that you're some kind of sellout or like you know, centrist.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, frankly, my sense is that that argument that you're talking about, those accusations come from people who aren't looking at what's inside the bill anyways. Like, you know, like I like,
well, I mean, they come from the National Nurses Union. They come from people who are, a lot of people, single-payer advocates know what's in the bill. I mean, the serious institutional ones, they know what's in the bill, of course. And they know what they're talking about, and they attack the alternative that I'm talking about.
And what about that? Have you read that John Walker piece? I mean, I think it came out just very recently.
John Walker's written this piece. I think that he is talking about the approach that I think that we should take. That I think is a better chance of winning the 105-year-old fight for universal health care in this country. As for the piece itself, he gives credit to Jacob Hacker at Yale, but it is Jacob Hacker's idea. And as far as John tackles the details, I don't think he does a great job, because he says things like, oh, we don't have to worry about the phase-in period. You know, I mean, you do have to worry about that. If you're going to say, I'm writing a piece that grapples with details, you got to grapple with the details. So I totally applaud his position. I agree with it. And at some point, people, and this is not up to John Walker, right? It's not his responsibility. But we do need to have a really, you know, a plan that says we're going to raise this tax that much and blah, blah, blah. And this is a mechanism by which we're going to get people who are not attached to the workforce into the program. I think that we should register everybody when they're born and just cover them until they come to a point where they either stay in the program or they get hired by a company that offers benefits.
Right. So it's
they end up in the military, right?
The default is you have health insurance, and then if somebody comes in and provides it for you on top of that, the default is
you can
with
opt
insurance.
Out. You can opt out.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're going to go to work for a company that self-insures, for example, they wouldn't have necessarily an incentive to go into this program that we're talking about, because they're not paying an insurance company's overhead.
Right.
They're not paying an insurance company's profits, right? They keep it in-house, and if you get a job with that, that's great. That's great. If you go into the military and get military coverage, that's great. No problem. But the difference is that you don't have to worry about signing up. So...
And we should be clear here. We should be clear here that this is only step one, because step two involves going out and saying, "Hey, we're going to maybe disaggregate some of these hospital mergers. We're going to start capping fees on certain procedures." Right? I mean, like that. We got to be clear here that this is, we're addressing universality, but the real cost control stuff is a whole separate question that. Maybe this type of system sets you up to do better, but it is a different
system. It absolutely does. But look, you will start addressing it by doing this, because you will have a insurance pool. By the way, it should be able to negotiate in tandem with the existing Medicare program. You'll have a huge pool to work with, not only to get to negotiate with providers. And remember, Medicare sets its reimbursement fees lower than the free market does, 80% or so. So you're already saving, without doing anything else, you're saving the difference between, you know, whatever number of people go into it, you're saving that difference. But then you also have not only a lot of bargaining clout, but you have this big pool of insured that you can use to figure out innovative ways to deliver services and to do payments and stuff like that, which the Medicare program is already tinkering with. So if you ask the, like, super wonks, so this gets into details that I don't even really understand, but if you ask them what the next frontier of cost control is, they'll say, yeah, we got to negotiate with providers, but they also say, look, we need to really rethink the way we think about sickness and health. And, you know, the next frontier is to pay people to keep us healthy, as opposed to paying people when we get sick to help us out, because it's actually one of those things where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Right. You're talking about housing. You're talking about making sure that people have access to food that keeps them healthy, as opposed to...
You think about it comprehensively, yeah. and in a much more kind of... And if you have this giant pool of, like, you know, whatever, 90 million people in Medicare Part E, you can do all sorts of things in terms of figuring... You have a giant pool that not only can negotiate with people, but also run experiments with these kinds of innovative ways of thinking about things to see and really get real-world results that have a huge cross-section of people.
Who would you consider at this point? I mean, and is there a Democratic politician who would not say now that broad principle that you're suggesting? Is there,
I think it's a victory, an unheralded victory for the Affordable Care Act, is that one thing that it succeeded in doing is winning the debate, the long debate about whether we should tolerate, you know, the status quo ante, and whether, you know, that the principle of universality, I think, is now established on the Democratic side.
But so
I can't name, you know, I don't know, maybe Manchin, I don't know.
But isn't
maybe
that
the most conservative?
But from a political standpoint, isn't that somewhat problematic? If there's nobody, if you're not laying down a policy prescription that nobody's outside of within the Democratic, broad Democratic left coalition, if nobody's outside that, is it really, I mean, can you get anywhere? Right? I mean, I'm talking from the politics of it.
I'm not following you, Sam.
If the principle is one, which is it's a basic right, right? That's what you're
yeah.
suggesting.
Yeah.
Because you're saying don't use the adoption of Medicare for All as a litmus test. But
don't use single payer as a litmus test.
Don't
you
single...
can have a mishmash of payers.
Okay. But I mean,
yeah.
But don't you need to have a litmus test? And
yeah, you should have a litmus test.
And if it's not a litmus test that excludes anybody who's not a Republican, isn't that like where's the fight? I mean, you know, like aren't you missing some of the people who might be inhibiting where you're going with this? Right? I mean,
first of all, I don't know if Heidi Heitkamp would pass the litmus test. I just don't know. Maybe.
Right.
I don't know. But look, are you saying that we can't be unified around something? I mean, we should be able to. If everybody passes a litmus test, that's not a bad thing. If the litmus test is itself a good thing. Right? So if you're saying, let's make the litmus test, everybody should have comprehensive care, and we've got to start really taking cost control seriously. If that's the litmus test and everybody passes it, I'm not going to complain. That's unity. Right now we're setting a litmus test on a specific approach, and a lot of people are going to be on different sides of that. So, I mean, when you get to the nitty-gritty details, you're obviously going to have very significant differences.
Right.
That is going to happen when you get into the sausage making. But I think that from principles, why not agree? I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
I just think that if you make it too broad, then, you know, you lose a little bit of control. And, you know, sometimes in the sausage making, you can have very different types of sausage.
That is
true.
To belabor the metaphor. But if you say, you know, we're not using universality as a euphemism, and if you're not coming to the table with a way to get us to universal coverage, truly universal coverage, you know, again, this is
I
think that's fine. And then we need to debate the best way to go.
I mean, personally, my feeling is like I want more than universality. I want it to be cheaper. I mean, I just, you know, as a kid, I was hitchhiking in Australia and I had gotten asthma. and or something. And I had to go see the doctor, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen times. And I just would go in, and I would pay $20. And, you know, I got, as far as I could tell, good care. And that was it. It was just
I mean, our healthcare system is deranged, but we have to start with what we have. I mean, but we are spending 18% of GDP on healthcare. The structure of how you, so I mean, again, and I'll go back to what I said earlier. These are two separate issues to a degree. They're absolutely related, but you know, if you want to make a litmus test about,
I mean, it seems to me
that we need to negotiate and put in cost controls. I will be on the progressive side of that, and I'm fine with that. You know, that's
I mean,
a good
maybe
litmus
that's
test to
I mean,
do.
Maybe that's where,
and that separates people.
Maybe that's where you start.
You know, are you on the side of the device manufacturers? Are you on the side of the pharmaceutical companies, or are you on the side of the people who say we need to control those costs aggressively?
Well, I guess, and I don't want to belabor that this, but I think my sense is that when you say Medicare for all, what people hear, as much as the for all part is, and they may be wrong about this, but they perceive something that's less complicated, more straightforward, and just a delivery mechanism that where job number one is just delivering medicine, not necessarily profit. And so, you know, I mean, like maybe, you know, I guess my point is that I think broadly speaking, that is what people really, I mean, universality, yes. And we know what's inhibiting universality now, right? It's the Republican Party is inhibiting it. I mean, largely speaking, but what's inhibiting the thing that people really want when they think about reform for healthcare delivery, it seems to me, includes people who think it should be a basic right. Because they don't really, because, you know, because you don't get to that second order question about basic right, which is like, it should also be like, it shouldn't have to be such a hassle. Like, it shouldn't have to be a source of anxiety. It shouldn't have to be a source of like, you know, like, and so maybe the first order fight is let's impose cost controls, because once you save that money, you know, then it's a lot easier to bring more people in.
Okay, but again, we're mixing two different issues here, because you just talked about simplicity, and I was saying let's register everybody automatically when they're born. There's nothing simpler than that. If you look at the existing Medicare system, though, and this is one of these things, it's like, oh, let's use Medicare to make a single-payer system. Medicare is not a single-payer system.
Right.
It has about a third of recipients of Medicare are taking private insurance plans that have to meet standards to qualify to be sold through Medicare. But this is the Medicare Advantage. When you retire and, you know, and you're ready to, and you become Medicare eligible, they send you like 300 pages of options.
Right.
There's nothing simple about it. And actually, it's a complaint that a lot of seniors have. They're like, this is bewildering. So Medicare Advantage is the private Medicare plans. And there's Part A, the traditional Medicare. Now, there's advantages to these. There's various advantages. But one big one that I talk about in the piece is that there's a cap on out-of-pocket expenses in the private plans, but not in the public plan. And that's really attractive if you're on Social Security, you have a fixed income, is to know that you have a cap on what will come out of your pocket.
Right.
And then in addition, because Medicare doesn't cover everything, then there's all these supplemental plans, Medigap plans, to cover your deductibles, to cover things that aren't covered. And then on top of that, there is both a public and an array of private Medicare prescription plans, Part D. So there is nothing simple about going on Medicare benefits. And it, just like Obamacare, you have one time every year that you can switch. You can't switch back and forth the rest of the year. It's complex. It's really complex. I say make the new Medicare Part E a public program, and maybe this is something that you can't get politically. Maybe it is the case that you need to sell to allow private insurers to sell through an exchange. But at least have a public option, you know, purely public option that is the default, and you just enroll everybody in that.
Yep. Well, Josh, it's I appreciate you coming on, and it's obviously, you know, something that people have to work out, because this is not these type of, you know, a greater understanding of these questions, I think, is really important before we get into a position where, you know, we can actually do something about it, right? I mean,
I'm glad we're having this argument now when we're in the wilderness three years before the next election, right? I mean, this is not the type of thing to argue during primaries.
That's why I wanted to have you on, and I enjoyed you writing the piece now, son, and I appreciate you coming on to talk about it. We will.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
We will link to the piece at majority.fm. Joshua Holland, thanks again.
Thanks, brother.
All right, bye-bye. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. What?
What a total nerd. Jesus Christ.
Oh, did I have that thing open? Did I have that audio? All right, it sounded all right.
Nerd
right?
alert.
Full-on nerd alert. We totally...
Medicare, because people have it. It's 18% of the economy. Shut up. Somebody could use a little bit of a work camp up in Burlington, couldn't they? How about not being a nation fellow and tapping some maple sap, learning how to be a goddamn human being? Get your head out of the freaking clouds.
I feel like Maoist Bernie's gotten a little bit more nasal. What happened? He's got a cold.
Maybe I have a cold. Maybe I wouldn't elaborate on it if I were you. I'll reappropriate your fucking brownstone before you turn your shoulder.
I would like you to reappropriate.
Yeah, you probably would like to go from Vermont and be separated from your family, wouldn't you?
Well, no, I would just
you
like
degenerate.
I want the brownstone. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein Seb Gorka. Oh God. Let's see. What do we got here? We got Stephen Miller talking about how offended he is that someone could imagine, you know, explaining a cosmopolitan bias. Did you know Jew, apparently, and I don't know if this is true, but I saw a tweet. I think it's we probably should double check. But apparently in a in dictionaries in Russia, like Jew is defined as like a cosmopolitan wanderer.
You know, it's interesting because Stephen Miller is actually the only Jew that I know of that actually signs his own name in parentheses.
That's right. And Seb Gorka explains to us the leverage that the United States has in foreign relations. Eric Boiling attempts to apply for a job to be in Donald Trump's press shop. Tucker Carlson brings on a Canadian, maybe a Canadian or a former English-speaking immigrant who has real problems with associating America with acceptance of immigrants. And then you have on, and Dave Rubin brings on just a... I guess a soft racist, not a blatant racist, soft racist.
And someone who is also a contender, you know, his guests are always repulsive, but they're not always as stupid as he is. And this woman seems pretty dumb.
Well, that's pretty good. And Michelle Bachmann blows the lid off of these hate crime hotlines, ladies and gentlemen. All this and more in the fun half of the program today. Just a reminder. Your support makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. If you are looking for something that's more trademark BS, head over to Patreon and support the Michael Brooks Show, which is, of course, it's an acronym for, what is it? What would you call it? Like a, it's really a euphemism for trademark BS.
It's at 1/10 of the support that Dave Rubin has, but haven't launched yet, so.
That is such a profoundly depressing way. Huh? You know, if I guess, yes, if I was unfunny and hosted Bigots, I would probably already have twice the Patreon.
I would even argue you don't even have to be unfunny. If you're even mildly amusing and you host Bigots, right, you're going to do well in this environment.
We need an idea exchange, and, you know, I don't think rape
the
even
important
exists.
Thing, the important thing.
And the regressives will try to shut me down for saying that, so go to my Patreon page.
The important thing is not just to have them on the show, but to also really just sort of like say, like, you really seem to be aggrieved. Also, folks, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy your crap through Amazon or Jet.com, please do so through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Reminder also, if you are one of those people who do not have the financial means to become a member of this program, but yet you want to hear the fun half because it's fun half. Oh, there's another thing. Yes, you're not paying attention. There's a fun half. It's a fun half song right here. You want me to send it to you? Well, it's in the Majority Reporters. Wow, this is getting to be a thing now. We're gonna have like a wealth.
Brilliant! If people are finally finding out a way of how to get away from that song, you just got to keep distracting us.
What?
Yeah.
It's actually grown on me. I don't know why.
Well, the situation.
I don't know why. It's not like over a year.
I don't get it.
All right, Matt. I just sent you that link to that song. I don't know what it is. It's from Lewis from Texas. I have not listened to it. What if it's incredibly offensive? Well, we'll stop it. I mean, we will.
Let's get to something fun. Let's get to something fun. Let's get to something fun.
Fun rap, fun rap, fun rap, fun rap.
And it's just as delicious as you could imagine. Just as delicious as you could imagine. Just as delicious as you could imagine.
Quick break, hey folks, reminder. Hey folks, reminder. Reminder. Hey folks, reminder. Hey folks, reminder.
Frankly, you're getting on my fucking nerves a little bit. Pretty upset. Upset.
Let's get to something fun. Let's get to something fun. Like the president lying, 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 lying to Boy Scouts.
Yeah, less about life.
Less about life. And it's just as delicious as you could imagine. Just as delicious as you could imagine.
Let's get to something fun.
Fun rap. Fun rap.
Quick, hey, folks, reminder. Hey, folks, reminder. Reminder.
Yeah. Less about life.
I like it, except for the part where it auto-tunes Sam to sound halfway normal. Saying
I like that auto-tuning. I got to get a hold of that.
You should use that with your kids.
I might be able to. I might be allowed to sing Happy Birthday at the next birthday party if I get an auto-tune. It's Milo's birthday this weekend. Well, coming up.
She's going to be 12?
She's going to be 12.
Well,
her birthday party is this weekend, but her birthday is next week sometime. I can't remember.
You are in for it.
Yeah, well, I feel like I'm already in it. But
You think that now.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun house.
said no, no.